Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. On our program tonight, Saskatchewan, a sorry state of affairs. The province's healthcare system buckles under the weight of a crushing surge in cases, now sending some ICU patients to Ontario. Did the premier wait too long to ask for help from the federal government? And will he say sorry for how he's handled the crisis? In moments, we'll ask the Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe just that. Then, mayors make history in Alberta.
We will set the bar high to deliver on your expectations, and we will remain accountable to all of you.
We have made the impossible possible.
Edmonton elects its first mayor of color, and Calgary chooses its first female for the top job. How will the two new leaders change their cities? Edmonton mayor-elect Amarjeet Sohi. Remember, he used to be a federal cabinet minister. And Calgary mayor-elect Jyoti Gondek joined the show today. Plus, Premier Ford on the defense.
You come here like every other new Canadian has come here. You work your tail off. If you think you're coming to collect the dole and sit around, not going to happen.
I am pro-immigration. I have been pro-immigration from day one. We are
short. Ontario Premier Doug Ford is accused of insensitive stereotyping for comments made about immigrants. Does the premier need to apologize? The press gallery will dig into that growing controversy. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. So Saskatchewan pulled an emergency COVID U-turn less than a week after the health minister there, Paul Merriman, declared there's no need to ask for federal help with COVID and assured the province that, don't worry, the healthcare system can handle the load of patients. All that has changed. Saskatchewan is now sending at least six ICU patients to Ontario to get treatment. And Premier Scott Moe announced yesterday that the province has now requested additional ICU staff from the federal government. Remember, this past month, Saskatchewan has had the highest rate of COVID-related deaths in the country, more than three times higher than the national average, the highest per capita rates of COVID, and among the lowest levels of vaccine rates, according to Health Canada. The system there is being overwhelmed by the unvaccinated. The unvaccinated folks there make up close to 80% of the hospital cases. So is this 180 from Saskatchewan too little too late? And what happened? Joining us now is Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe. Premier Moe, always a pleasure to have you on the program. The stats about Saskatchewan are terrible, sir, as you know. In July, with less than 70% of the population vaccinated with one dose, you chose essentially to drop all restrictions in that three quick step process. You were warned not to do it. Are you apologizing now for how you handled the pandemic?
No, I don't think anyone has a roadmap on exactly how you manage your way through a pandemic. What we're running into here in Saskatchewan and is the fourth wave is hitting our communities hard. We have, you know, a lower vaccination rate than many other provinces, higher than many other areas of the world, but lower than many other provinces. And in particular, we have, you know, a number of communities, often rural and remote communities, that have quite a low vaccination rate. And it is ultimately those that have made the choice not to get vaccinated that are ending up in our ICU department here in Saskatchewan, and really creating that indirectly, that pressure on our entire healthcare service system as we transfer, slow down services and transfer services to support those folks that are in our ICU department.
Premier,
and ultimately now I've shipped six out and we'll have discussions later this week as if we need to ship maybe some more people out as well.
But Premier, let's talk straight. I know you said there's no roadmap, but you did have a lot of health advice, and other provinces took a very different map than you. In July, no masks in public areas, no limits on public gatherings, no limits on bars and restaurants. You didn't change that stuff till September. You still didn't even then put limits on gathering. Those are your choice. So I'm asking you, do you take responsibility for that? Were those choices a mistake? And as you've been asked in your province, will you apologize for those decisions?
When we look at the public health measures that were put in September, they are starting to work here in the province. Our numbers are decreasing, and even our hospitalizations are starting to decrease over the last 10 days. Our ICUs have not. They continue to be far too high here in this province. And so when we look back at when we implemented the the public health measures in September. It's fair to say that we should have moved earlier than we did, maybe a week or two earlier than we did, and it would have preserved some of the capacity that we really desire to have in our healthcare here system, in our healthcare system. And in doing so, we have folks in Saskatchewan now that are not able to access services. We have kids that aren't able to access some of the therapies, whether it be right. speech or physical therapies that they need, surgeries. And you know, for that, this government takes responsibility and, yes, does apologize to the people of Saskatchewan for not acting a week or two quicker with the measures that we have in place now that are proving to be effective, as it would have saved us some of the challenging decisions that we had to make this week.
But Premier, when you apologize for that, are you literally saying that it's just a week or two earlier? Or was there that sense when you, and I know Alberta, when you were kind of having that open for business summer, and other provinces, I live in Ontario, it wasn't doing the same thing. BC wasn't, Quebec wasn't. There was a much larger step process. Again, I just ask you, sir, do you take accountability for those mistakes? Because here you are sending patients to Ontario. I'm just trying to get accountability on this because it's a really critical thing. Lives are on the line. Those decisions eventually fall on your shoulders. Do you take responsibility for it?
Absolutely. Lives have been on the line throughout this pandemic, and we're very fortunate as Saskatchewan to be in a nation like Canada where we can support one another. And we're unfortunately, it's Saskatchewan right now that is on the receiving end of that support and sending our patients to, six of our patients to Ontario. And for that, we're forever grateful to the Ford government and the people of Ontario and the healthcare system in Ontario. But as I said earlier in this pandemic, we were able to provide that type of support to other areas, including Ontario. So this is new for all of us across Canada and around the world. And I think as we, you know, look ahead and look at the lessons that we've learned and understand that we have tools today and in the weeks ahead that we really haven't had in the early days of this pandemic. In the early days, all we had was public health measures. But as we look ahead to the next number of weeks, there's a number of other tools that we now have access to. And we in Saskatchewan are most certainly going to make use of every tool we have to drive you know, our hospitalization rate down. And we've done that with the public health measures that are now implemented.
Your system is on the brink of having to triage people. As you say, you've sent people over. Triage meaning who shall live, who shall die. The Health Minister, Patty Hajdu, had said in late September that she spoke to her Saskatchewan counterpart, Minister Merriman, about federal government being ready to help. No request came. I spoke to the Saskatchewan opposition leader, Dr. Ryan Miley, and he told me on question period that you, sir, put politics ahead of people's lives and you should have asked for help from the federal government earlier. Here's what he told me.
Experts in public health, even our own chief medical health officer, were giving advice. He was ignoring it for political reasons. He put politics ahead of people's lives.
He's saying you ignored public health advice because you didn't want to look like you were turning to the federal government for help. And he said that was you neglected to do it and it was a very costly thing. What's your response to that and why didn't you ask for help earlier?
Nothing could be further from the truth. We have put together our joint command center, our provincial emergency operations center, which is the furthest thing from a political organization that is working with working through all of the relationships that we have, both within Canada, outside of Canada, and with the federal government. And they have been working quite closely with the federal government throughout the course of the last number of days. Ultimately, came forward to us as the government today, or sorry, on Monday, and had put forward the request to the federal government for some very specific resources to support a number of ICU beds here in Saskatchewan. That letter was sent from our health minister then on the advice of that emergency operations center, which I would take great issue with what the leader of the opposition has said. Nothing could be further from this being having anything to do with politics. It has to everything to do with supporting the people of Saskatchewan. And as I said, we're very fortunate to be in a nation where a province like Ontario can provide us with some of that support here at this time, as Saskatchewan did earlier in the pandemic.
The Regina Leader Post says that the head of Saskatchewan's public safety agencies says the province first sought out help from a number of American states before seeking help from the federal government. Is that true?
No, what the Provincial Emergency Operations Center was doing was relying and sourcing what type of capacity they had through all of the relationships that they had. Yes, some of those were U.S. states, but at the same time, they were also in discussions with the federal government as to what type of human resource capacity the federal government would actually be able to provide Saskatchewan. So that ask has went into the federal government at the same time that they identified that there was some capacity in beds in Ontario, and that's why we made both decisions to request the assistance of the federal government, some very specialized assistance in the way of human resources, but also to request to move a half a dozen Saskatchewan patients into facilities in Ontario to ensure that everyone can continue to have the highest quality of care that's available.
Just last thing, Premier, again, and it's tragic to say that right now the highest death rates right now in COVID is in your province, but the lowest vaccination rates are among the lowest vaccinations. Again, why? Who's responsible for the fact that your province has some of the lowest vaccination rates? Do you think you needed vaccine mandates earlier, not lifting everything in the summer? Again, was that a mistake?
The proof of vaccination program is proving to be effective in Saskatchewan. I think will prove to be very helpful in the weeks and months ahead. We've delivered since we implemented this program over 125,000 vaccines in Saskatchewan. That's up three or four times on our daily administration.
No, I know that, basis. But my question is, did you
positive.
Do it too late?
Yeah. Likely.
I get it,
yeah,
but did you do it too late?
That's the key issue
yeah. because of the crisis.
Yeah, you know, to my earlier statements, Quebec had moved about a month before we did. We had moved on October the 1st. And that is, precisely one of the items that we maybe should have been looking at moving earlier with respect to that. And it would have provided, some breathing room to our hospitalization system. But at the end of the day, we continue to have, as I said, a number of communities in this province. And we're working very hard with those community leaders to, push our vaccination rates along here in Saskatchewan through the proof of vaccination policy, but also through, reaching out to leaders in these quite often rural and remote communities to see what we can do to, one, the vaccines are already available, but to encourage people and make sure they fully understand the impact that the unvaccinated population is having on our healthcare system here in Saskatchewan.
I got to leave it there. Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe, thank you for joining us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Okay, we'll pick up on that a little later, but let's head next door to Alberta. Alberta's two biggest cities made history last night. Jyoti Gondek voted as Calgary's first ever female mayor. She's a former city councillor. She's got a PhD in urban planning. And Amarjeet Sohi became the first person of color to be chosen mayor of Edmonton. Immigrant, worked his way up from being a bus driver, city councillor. Then, of course, we know him as the federal infrastructure minister here in Ottawa under Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. As Alberta struggles to get a grip on the fourth wave, what will these new mayors do to bend the curve? And what are their plans to change the cities? It is a delight to be joined now by Calgary Mayor-elect Jyoti Gondek and Edmonton Mayor-elect Amarjeet Sohi. Well, well, well. Amazing moments. Amarjeet Sohi, I know you well. It's my first time meeting Mayor-elect Gondek, so I'll start with you, Mayor-elect Gondek. First of all, congratulations to both of you on big victories. What is the win signal to you and Mayor Gondek, and what is your plan for Calgary?
Well, thanks so much for having me on, and I think this win signals that Calgarians were ready for a vision on how we get back on track. And it is a pleasure to be able to serve and bring back some resilience to our city.
Okay, let me go to Mayor-elect Sohi. Man, I keep interviewing you different positions. Congratulations to you, sir. You also made history. Tell us what you are going to do in Edmonton and the message and your plan as now the mayor of Edmonton.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I want to congratulate Mayor-elect Gondek. We call each other Jyoti and Amarjeet because we have known each other during my time as infrastructure minister. I am so excited about the opportunities that we have here in Alberta. Absolutely, COVID-19 and fourth wave has impacted so many Albertans, and here in Edmonton is causing havoc. We have proposed certain number of initiatives, including requiring vaccination for employees, as well as proof of vaccination for people accessing city services, as well as supporting cultural communities with pop-up vaccination clinics and making city facilities available. I spoke with the premier today. I offered him my support once I'm sworn in to do whatever we can to control this fourth wave.
Mayor-elect Gondek, let me go to you, because Mayor-elect, so he's talking about the pandemic. I mean, the pandemic, the crisis in the oil sector, just two of the major issues hitting your city. I know the pandemic economically and from a health point of view, you're still in the grip of the fourth wave. How will you work with the provincial government there, and what is your priority on those two issues going forward?
Well, let me offer my congratulations back to Mayor-elect Sohi. And as he said, we have implemented a lot of measures down here in Calgary as well, offering vaccination buses, encouraging people to get vaccinated. We're demonstrating leadership by showing that we've been vaccinated as members of council. And we continue to clarify some of the expectations that were laid out by the provincial government so that our businesses and social service organizations can keep their doors open and have some sort of certainty and predictability around what a safe environment looks like. But together with Mayor-elect Sohi and other municipal leaders in our province, we will be asking the provincial government to ensure that they're taking the measures that are needed when they're needed and not wait as they have in the past.
Mayor-elect Sohi, I want to get to an issue that we're covering as well in this program. The Premier of Ontario has been asked to apologize, but he won't, for comments he made about immigrants. And speaking of the need for more skilled labor, and I know for both of you, skilled labor is a shortage across this country, but he said this: we need people. And if you have some hardworking people, folks, I have one criteria. You come here like any other new Canadian has come here. You work your tail off. He said, if you think you can come to collect the dole and sit around, it's not going to happen. Go somewhere else. Mayor-elect Sohi, what is your reaction to those remarks?
No, I was absolutely disappointed in Premier Ford's comments. I think it really, really enforces this stereotype, this bias that certain immigrants are a burden on society, that they don't come here to hard work, or they're here to take advantage of the system, which is far from the truth. Absolutely not the case. I started my journey here scraping floors, so flipping burgers in fast food restaurants, and then drove a taxi, then worked for DAS, worked for Edmonton Transit. Then Edmonton took a chance on me to elect me to city council. And I've been serving this community from day one. And that is the journey and story of thousands of immigrants. I think to marginalize people with comments such as Premier Ford's are very unfortunate.
I'm going to ask you as well, Mayor-elect Jyoti Gondek, what are your thoughts on those comments?
I think it's unfortunate that comments like that are still being made in this day and age, when we can see that newcomers to our country are not coming here to freeload. They're actually coming here looking for opportunity. And if you open your eyes and take a look around, you will see a lot of people who are highly educated and highly qualified, whose credentials and skills are not being recognized, but they're still continuing to work for a living. They are doing the types of jobs that others simply don't feel like doing. And so to put the burden of collecting the dole on immigrants is absolutely ridiculous, sends the wrong message, and it is something that he should be apologizing for.
You think he should be apologizing for it? All right. First of all, I hope we have many more conversations to both of you. This is a day. Look at you. I've get you for the first interview. You're not even in the job yet. And I'm already getting you to weigh in on national issues, but the jobs you both have are so important. I know the mayors that you replaced were also national figures. So Calgary Mayor-elect Jyoti Gondek and Edmonton Mayor-elect Amarjeet Sohi, congrats to both of you. I just appreciate you taking the time. I wish you good luck dealing with real crises in your province and your cities. And you're always welcome on the program. Thank you both.
Thank you
so much for having us.
All right, a pleasure to have you both. Okay, so history made there in those two cities. Let me give you an update on the kidnapping situation in Haiti right now. The gang that kidnapped a group of 17 missionaries in that country has reportedly asked for a total of $17 million US dollars for their release. the 16 Americans and one Canadian were on their way home from an orphanage in a suburb just outside Port-au-Prince Saturday when they were kidnapped by the powerful 400 Mawozo gang. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that the Haitian justice minister said the group is being held in a safe house. And of course, as you can imagine, they are demanding $1 million for each person's release. Foreign Affairs Minister Mark Garneau not available for an interview today, and Global Affairs isn't saying much about the case, but they did release a statement, and I'll just read it to you in part, saying Global Affairs Canada is aware that a Canadian citizen was kidnapped in Haiti. The consular officials are in contact with the family of the individual and are providing consular assistance. Canada takes the situation very seriously and is collaborating with Haitian and American policing authorities as well as implicated NGOs on the incident. All right, coming up, Iqaluit's water crisis rages on. Earlier today, the city extended its state of emergency, but how long can residents there go without using their tap water, and what will it take to make sure the city has safe drinking water? The Iqaluit mayor, Kenny Bell, will join us again. Always good to have him on the program. Stay with us. Iqaluit's water crisis continues. Today, that city extended its state of emergency, which began a week ago. Remember, Iqaluit says testing shows that there's a high concentration of fuel in the tank at the city's main water treatment center. How long before the situation runs Iqaluit literally dry, and what will it take to ensure access to safe water finally? Let's bring in Iqaluit's mayor, Kenny Bell. Mayor Bell, always a pleasure to have you back on the program. I know you've extended the state of emergency. Outline the current situation. Where are you guys at right now?
Yeah, thank you for having me, Evelyn. You know, we're still kind of in limbo. You know, Nunavut is a remote location, and Iqaluit is no different. We're on a Baffin Island, and it takes us forever to get supplies in and people. So we actually just had our airline, you know, get a couple people on a full flight for tomorrow morning, a couple engineers that were going to help us, get to the bottom of the situation. But, you know, we're a little bit closer, but we still need more testing and some more experts to come up and see the actual problem.
How, I know the city's in the process of flushing the water distribution system to get contaminants out. So give us what are we waiting for in terms of flushing the system, finding out what the cause is, and maybe when people can get some fresh water?
Yeah, so the problem tank has been isolated and, you know, it's empty. And now we've taken pictures, and of course there's been a visual inspection, but we need a different kind of inspection and actually a different expert to come up and do those inspections. So we are flying them in tomorrow. They'll get down in that tank. It's a team of four got to go down in the tank and clean it, and because you know just naturally there's sediment in those tanks, so they got to clean it first and see if there is cracks. But you know. We're in this limbo of waiting for supplies and people.
Gosh, and so give me a sense of how long, because I know the Iqaluit Hospital is the one hospital in the entire territory. It's only performing emergency surgery. So, is that sustainable, sir?
You know, nothing. Not one part of this is sustainable, Evan. You know, this is taxing on not only on our citizens, but all of our workers. You know, our airline that has been fantastic in helping us bring everything in. The government employees that are working day and night. The city employees are working day and night. You know, it's just none of this is this isn't easy. It's one of the hardest things you can imagine.
Yeah. How is there any kind of for the citizens, any sense of how long you'll be flying in water?
For the short term, I think the government of Nunavut is asking the government of Canada for some help today. I think that information will be released tomorrow. I'm not 100% sure, but it's gonna be a little while.
Have they consulted with you?
Yes.
Have they consulted with you on what to ask for, and what do you want from the government?
Yeah, they're asking for some water treatment plant to be delivered from the Canadian military, I believe.
Oh, so like a portable water treatment plant from the military on an emergency expedited basis for the city. And how much water could that pump out?
You know, I don't know. I think it is capable of delivering the water to half of our residents that are on truck service. Right now, we're taking water from a river. The river is freezing. You know, winter is coming upon us real fast. We got lucky with the last couple weeks being nice, and you know, we're not in a great situation here.
Mayor Bell, you know, we're going to call you because we really want to help you out and make sure this story gets told. So I hope we'll continue our calls this week, and we'll look forward to seeing if the military provides that and if the federal government will rush that water treatment in. Mayor Kenny Bell, we're thinking about you and all the citizens. Thank you, sir.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. That's Mayor Kenny Bell from Iqaluit. And again, just 9,000 people. No fresh water, and they just don't know how long. So think about that, and we'll watch if there's news out of from the Nunavut government to the federal government on that. But coming up, an outcry over comments that the Ontario Premier Doug Ford made about immigrants. He's facing a backlash after saying he only wants hardworking people to come to the province, not immigrants who he said would, quote, sit around and, quote, collect the dole. Should he retract the remarks? He won't apologize, but the press gallery is going to weigh in on that. Stay with us.
I just have one criteria. You come here like every other new Canadian has come here. You work your tail off. If you think you're coming to collect the dole and sit around, not going to happen. Go somewhere else. You want to work? Come here. We have so much work. We can't keep up with it right now.
Coming to collect the dole and sit around. Those are comments from Ontario Premier Doug Ford yesterday addressing the province's very real labor shortage. He specified, as you said, he only wants working immigrants, not going to sit around and collect the dole. Now, those comments have ignited a lot of controversy around the province. Opposition leaders are saying he's trafficking in stereotypes that are not true. They're demanding an apology. We just saw the two mayor-elect in Alberta, both in Calgary and in Edmonton, saying that he should apologize, but Premier Ford refused to back down today at Queen's Park, saying, why would I? I'm pro-immigration. Listen to this.
All you have to do is come to a Ford Fest. You'll see the support from people around the world that come there. And guess what, Mr. Speaker? I'll tell you how Ford Nation was created. They came to this country. They couldn't get a hold of any NDP Liberal leaders, but they got a hold of the Mayor of Toronto. They got a hold of the Premier. We show up to their door. We return their call.
Okay, look, let's just get the data and then we can get to the politics. According to Stats Canada, immigrants are a key part of Canada's economic growth. There's no evidence that immigrants, quote, sit around and collect the dole. There's none. Data available shows employment rates for immigrants and Canadian-born citizens close to the same. The Centre for Policy Alternatives has a study that shows immigrants use less income support programs than Canadian-born citizens. So does the Premier need to apologize for his comments, or is he, as he right, says, a pro-immigrant who's just asking people to work hard? Press gallery is going to weigh in. Fatima Syed is a reporter with the Narwhal and hosts the podcast The Backbench. Stephanie Levitz, as her mom insists I call her, I just can't get through that, is a Parliament Hill reporter with the Toronto Star's Ottawa Bureau. And Dr. Ahmed Aria is a palliative care doctor. He works in long-term care facilities. Good to see you all. I'm going to start with you, Dr. Aria. You tweeted out today, quote, immigrants help to staff hospitals, care for our elders in long-term care, drive our trucks and buses and taxis, farm the fruit and vegetables we eat, staff the Amazon warehouses we order from. And Premier Ford accused immigrants of not working hard enough. Okay, explain, you clearly were very impacted by them. What's your reaction to the fact that he's doubled down today and essentially says he won't apologize?
Well, I think it's absolutely appalling. And I mean, these comments are racist. They're xenophobic, sort of treating immigrants as, you know, not as human beings, but treating them either as good or bad work machines is really, you know, just once again, you know, appalling. And I don't have words to express how I felt actually after hearing the Premier's comments. It was extremely triggering. But what I've been reflecting on today, Evan, is actually how this racism translates into policymaking. And as a palliative care physician who's worked on the front lines of the COVID COVID-19 pandemic. I've gone into long-term care facilities and talked to PSWs who were racialized. There were women, there were new immigrants to Canada, and they weren't provided enough PPE. They were working without proper masks. They were working without gowns, and they were actually still coming to work and risking their lives looking after our loved ones in long-term care. Working in Peel Region until the end of March of 2021, I actually saw so many people who were getting sick from COVID-19 and even dying from COVID-19 who didn't deserve to die because the province delayed on paid sick days, and they actually diverted vaccines away from racialized communities which needed them the most. So I think that's really what we have to think about, where undoubtedly the words are terrible, but how does this translate into policymaking?
Okay, Fatima, I want you to weigh in. You just wrote this article here I've got in front of me, The Labor of Immigrant Women in Ontario, for the publication The Local. So it's an issue, obviously, you studied. What is your reaction to hearing this comment?
Look, I think there's a fundamental gap between what the premier said and the reality on the ground. Throughout the entire pandemic, the people I spoke to the most were workers, and they were immigrant workers, and they were, as Dr. Arya said, in the essential economy. They were keeping Canada open when the rest of us were at home, and the majority of them did not get recognized for that. They did not benefit from the emergency benefits that have been put in place. They were not protected soon enough. They did not feel safe, and now they're not being appreciated and they're not being valued. I think it's unfair for the premier to say that the solution for a skilled worker shortage is just to get, quote, hardworking immigrants, which implicitly implies that there are immigrants who are just sitting around doing nothing. The chances are, Evan, if you've been in an Uber or a taxi, you've probably been driven around by a very qualified doctor, engineer, dentist, teacher, business person, lawyer. There are skilled immigrants here who are begging to do the works that they have been trained for, but there is no foreign credential program. There is no government at any level thinking about, how do we actually allow the immigrants that we're bringing here to do the work that they are qualified for. So it's very easy for the premier to make blanket statements like this. It's much harder to put in policies that will actually help immigrants become even more essential than they already are to the Canadian economy. And I think that's what hurts, It's the fact that all my aunties and uncles are overqualified for the jobs that they're doing, that they're making sacrifice after sacrifice to just be a part of the Canadian labor force that does not have an appropriate place for them. And frankly, that does not appreciate them, as we learned yesterday from the premier's comments.
Steph, premier said, look, I'm as pro-immigrant as it gets. Ford Nation is built on these immigrant communities. I'm not going to say sorry for the comments. What did you make of the comments and how the impact of them?
So, why didn't he just stop talking? Why didn't he just stop at the line, if you want work, come to Ontario? Because that would have been fair. Economic growth in this country is fueled by immigration year after year after year. Our population growth does not keep up our natural population growth. We need immigration. And the immigration system has been sorely tested by the COVID-19 pandemic. And I know that, all levels of government, I think, are now working flat out to resume that engine, to get it going again, because it's essential for the economic growth in this country. So I think there's absolutely, in fact, nothing wrong with saying, come to Ontario, move to Canada, come find a job. Why he had to keep going, I don't know. And then to take the approach today, I don't mean to be cliche or cavalier about it, but some of my best friends are immigrants is effectively what he was trying, what it sounded like he was saying there. And, why not instead have a ream of data in front of him, like the numbers that you reeled off at the top of the show, Evan, that actually prove what it was I think he was trying to, in his Freudian way, say, which is that he's well aware of the contributions new Canadians make to the economy. And there is data to back that up. He could have gone with the facts instead of political discourse and jabbing at his rivals on the floor of the House of Commons and undone the damage he had done. Just look at the facts, Premier Ford, and use them.
Yeah. Dr. Arya, you could weigh in on that. But in the midst of this, there's a real health crisis. By the way, as you pointed out, the COVID crisis has actually impacted people of color in different communities and immigrant communities in a much more significant way, as you pointed out. But now we've got this next issue, and I'd love to get, as a doctor, your view on this notion that Pfizer is saying that Health Canada, they're asking to approve the first dose of COVID-19 vaccine for children 5 to 11. Now, we've had some people concerned about the safety of Pfizer for adults. What's your take on that, Doc, and the impact that that could have?
Yeah, so it's a very important stage of the pandemic. I mean, here in Ontario, we have 1.7 million unvaccinated children who are aged 5 to 11. And Pfizer has now submitted data, as you pointed out, Evan, to Health Canada to get approval. So I think at this point in time, we have to wait. We have to wait for Health Canada to do their job. We have to wait for this rigorous scientific process and regulatory approvals, you know, to go through. And of course, Health Canada will only approve the vaccine if the benefits of the vaccine in this age group outweigh the risks. At the same time, I think from what we've seen in the rollout so far from, you know, for ages 12 and up, I think it, you know, definitely tells us some learned lessons where all provinces across the country have to start planning their rollout for children at this time, age 5 to 11. And that should include equitable access to the vaccine for children who are most vulnerable and should probably include also a science communications plan because there's so much misinformation that we're countering, you know, out here about the vaccine, where people just don't have the right information. They're getting their sources off Facebook and they're not sure what's right or wrong. So we have to proactively counter that in a culturally safe and respectable way.
Okay, I'm going to take a break because we've got a big segment on the other side and I want to get Fatima and Steph on that. But Dr. Arya, first of all, what a pleasure to have you on the program. I really appreciate it and hope you come back. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Fatima and Stephanie will stick around because when we come back, the clock is set to run out on the federal COVID-19 program, some of them this week, but a decision from Cabinet could extend the shelf life on the Canada Wage Subsidy and the Canada Emergency Red Subsidy. Should Cabinet make the move to extend the benefits into November? And is there going to be a gap? Some of them are only going to be extended till November 20th. Parliament doesn't come back till the 22nd. Are some programs going to fall through the crack? NDP MP Peter Julian, the NDP's House leader, is very concerned about that. He'll join us next as we debate to extend or not to extend. Stay with us. Pandemic, of course, still not over, but some federal COVID-19 aid might be. Key government aid is set to expire this weekend. Support could be extended until late November for a number of programs with a decision from Cabinet. In other words, Parliament doesn't have to be back for that, but they haven't done that yet. Is the government putting undue anxiety on businesses and individuals who are days away from having these emergency benefits expire, or have the emergency benefits run their course? Should they be expired? And should Parliament be called back earlier to make sure some of them just don't run out? The press gallery's back. Fatima Syed, a reporter with the Narwhal. Stephanie Levitz is a Parliament Hill reporter with the Star, the Ottawa Bureau. And our special guest is Peter Julian. He is the House leader for the NDP. Okay, everyone's back. Mr. Julian, welcome to the table here. Cabinet can extend the emergency wage and rent subsidies. They haven't done it yet. What do you think they need to do? And does Parliament need to come back early to do it?
Absolutely. Parliament needs to be meeting as soon as possible. MPs are being sworn in this week, next week. There's no reason to wait until the end of November. And at this critical time with the pandemic and the fact that so many Canadian families are relying on the recovery benefit to actually put food on the table, so many small businesses have been hanging on by their fingernails, and yet we have all this uncertainty and the government delaying for more than 2 months a recall of Parliament that should take place much sooner than that. So Jagmeet Singh and the NDP have been asking that we get back to work immediately, and that will allow, I think, some assurance to families and small businesses that are struggling that indeed relief will be on the way, that there will be supports in place for them. They won't be abandoned.
Staff at Cabinet can extend that, the emergency wage and rent subsidies. They don't need legislation, although they might need it for others. But on the other side, there are those that say, look, some of these programs just shouldn't be extended. The economy's bounced back. Some of the big companies that got some of these subsidies have paid dividends. We shouldn't extend their benefits to that. What's the pro-con argument here to extend or not to extend, Steph?
Well, wasn't that the election that we were just supposed to have had? I mean, wasn't that the point of having that federal election, is that there were urgent decisions urgently required to urgently be made on the future of the Canadian economy post-pandemic? And I think that what must be so frustrating to small businesses, to Canadians on these benefits, because the Prime Minister made the case he had to go to the polls because the decisions getting taken today would lay the groundwork for the future. He didn't say those decisions would be taken 2 months from now. And I think it is fair to say that the economic landscape of today is not the same landscape as when these benefits were originally designed. There needs to be some room for tweaking. We know at this point, you know, what works and what doesn't. There's been some really good work done by economists like those who've advised the Prime Minister in the past, for example, about winding down the wage subsidy, one that, you know, may not really be needed anymore considering what the economy is actually doing. Other things like direct supports to people may in fact still be needed if they work in places where their businesses aren't back at full capacity. Maybe it's a regional approach. There are all sorts of debates that can be had about what the right thing is to do, and the right place to be having those debates is in Parliament. And so the question then becomes, what happens? The Cabinet can only extend these for a month. Parliament still won't be back in time. So do we end up in this never land of the economy where absolutely nothing is getting done? And I don't think anybody, least of all parliamentarians and certainly Canadians, want that to be the state of affairs.
Right. By the way, when Parliament comes back for November 22nd, Fatima, they'll probably sit for 3 weeks and boom, they're on another 6 week break. So what the heck can get done there? But on the other side, there are, you know, we have this asymmetrical recovery. Some folks and some businesses still need support. Then you've got a lot of business groups on the other hand saying, we can't find any labor. You've got lots of industries are saying, we got help wanted signs. No, we can't hire anybody. We've all heard that as well. How does the government make the decision of whether to extend or not to extend? Fatima.
I don't think the question is how. I think the question is why haven't they already figured this out? I'm not surprised that we're here again. We've seen this throughout the pandemic where you have a policy, they put it in for a short amount of time and ignore the fact that, you know, once that policy ends, the impacts will still be there. Things will still be on fire. You know, the pandemic will still be going on. Businesses will still be hurting. The economy will still be declining. Workers will still need help. And the government's just not prepared. And that frankly blows my mind a little bit, where they're just not thinking long term enough. This, we're now 18 months in, probably, if I do the math right in my brain on live TV. But you would have expected that the government would have had contingency plans, plans A's, plan B's, plan C's, to have, you know, even if the plan was always to wean workers off these benefits, how do you help them after that? Have you strengthened the labor force enough so that workers have a safety net, that their jobs are secure, that their income will still be entering their bank accounts, that their jobs will still be there when these benefits end? There are no answers to that, and that's what's concerning to me, that they're not even talking about that and they're not prepared for it.
I thought we were 19 months, by the way. Maybe we're 18 months. Sometimes it feels like 18 years, and we're the lucky ones. For a lot of people, it probably feels longer. Peter, Julian, let me just go back to you. I'm just trying to figure this out. The Canadian Federation of Independent Businesses says extend the benefits. I was doing this on national radio today. There are thousands of businesses who are desperate for workers, and they believe that the support system is suppressing the workforce in some industries, you know, hospitality, restaurants. They cannot find workers. How do we make this a little more surgical?
Well, we bring Parliament back so we can have those discussions. But I can tell you, Evan, here in New Westminster, BC, when I talk to small business owners, a lot of them find the lack of affordable housing, the fact that the federal government has done nothing now for 6 years to actually provide affordable housing for people, that is a major impediment to getting for the labor force, because people can't afford to live in the community. And these are things that need to be talked about, of course, providing a labor force strategy. But the reality is there are hundreds of thousands of families that need the recovery benefit to put food on the table. That has got to be a priority right now. And for Mr. Trudeau to wait more than 2 months with the same parliament that we had before the election was called just seems to indicate a lack of concern for those many families and many small businesses that are struggling right now.
Yeah, Steph, you've seen this before. Like, what do you make of the fact that, you know, Parliament hasn't sat for months and months and months, and there's just, as Mr. Julian says, there's a long delay to get back to work here.
Yeah, you know, that is what I make of it, because it doesn't make sense. I mean, there's international things coming up. We know the Prime Minister is focused on those. We know the Prime Minister took a bit of a holiday, which is family. Nobody is begrudging him taking some time off. I think everybody deserved a few days after the election. But again, I return to this idea that he sold the nation a bill of goods, saying I needed an election because urgent decisions needed to get made. And I don't see the urgency in his actions. We'll get a new cabinet, I believe, you know, it's next week, I think, or the week after we're going to get cabinet, then parliament comes back. We know their priorities are climate change. We know he's meeting with the opposition leaders this week. So we're seeing signs of activity. I mean, calls are getting made, meetings are being taken. But there are big decisions that have to get made, and it would be nice to have a sense that the work is being done to make them, and it's not just going to be another series of statements about decisions that will be taken in due course, and always preface with the words, we know Canadians expect. Canadians expect their parliamentarians to go to work. That's what Canadians expect.
Yeah, I just got about 30 seconds here. Mr. Julian, I just don't know. Given the fact that we've got the date for cabinet swearing in, I just don't know how they get back to work sooner, but I guess they could technically come back at least a week or two sooner. I got about 10 seconds, but could they come back earlier, right after cabinet, Mr. Julian?
Yes. I mean, as soon as members of parliament are sworn in, and that's happening right now.
Yeah.
So yes, they could. We could accelerate the swearing in process and have parliamentarians back at work in early November.
All right. I can't accelerate or decelerate the time on our show, so I got to leave it there. Peter Julian, we don't control this time. Fatima Syed, Steph Levitz, great to have the three of you on the program. I appreciate it. As always, your perspectives. Do take care. And to all of you watching, that is your Power Play Day in Politics. Thanks for watching. We will be back here in 23 short hours. Trust me, hug your loved ones if you can. It is an absolute gift. Have a great evening. We'll see you tomorrow. We'll